It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here. Our Valentine's Day special. That's why I'm wearing red. Steve's Valentine to you. He says the best picture he's ever shown on any episode. If you're not watching video, we'll describe it. We'll also get you all the news. For instance, why is it's Patch Tuesday? Where's the patch? It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 599, recorded Valentine's Day, Tuesday, February 14th, 2017. TLS interception in security. Security Now is brought to you by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect it from ransomware and hacker attacks with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free at Carbonite.com. Use the offer code SecurityNow to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. And by Audible. To download a free audiobook of your choice with a 30-day free trial, go to audible.com/SecurityNow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security online. Steve Gibson is here. The GRC, Gibson Research Corporation. And Steve, before we begin, we should mention a couple of milestones. This is episode 599. Next week is our 600th episode.
Woohoo! I did notice that TWiT was 601, so we're catching up.
We're two ahead. Yes. But TWiT takes... actually, we used to take time off. I haven't done that in a long time, so... And you never take time off, so I don't know. This may be a neck-and-neck race for some time.
I'm going to hang in there.
However, I'm also happy to say I was just taking a look at the numbers, and this is now, after TWiT, the highest-rated show on the network. It's TWiT number one, Security Now number two.
Cool.
So congratulations. This show has been growing like crazy over the last 2 years, something like 30% year every year. And I think that that's because, well, it's a great show, but also people are very interested in this topic now, aren't they?
Well, it's certainly one that just keeps on giving.
Yes.
We have a bunch of fun stuff. The title for today's podcast is TLS Interception in Security. A fabulous paper was produced after a bunch of very interesting research into the surprising number, larger by an order of magnitude than these experts in the industry expected, in the number of HTTPS connections which are being intercepted. It wasn't known to be that big. And unfortunately, they found just a huge number of problems with this. So, and you know, all listeners to this podcast know that this has been, you know, a source of angst for me for a long time. For a long time, my position was corporations should absolutely not be doing this. And then I kind of came around saying, well, okay, but how can they monitor their traffic if they're not able to look inside the connections, which are increasingly TLS tunneled, not plain text? And then, of course, we've also discussed the worrisome problem with the AV software, which is now doing this to end users, typically without their having any awareness of it. So this paper is wonderful, and we'll wrap up the podcast with that. But we have, interestingly, a delayed Patch Tuesday, and we may know why. We were talking about this last week. Our favorite ad blocker has—well, it's more than an ad blocker. It's not fair to call it that. In fact, Gorehill gets annoyed when people call uBlock Origin an ad blocker. But it has embraced the last major browser that was a long-term holdout. A university, an unnamed university, has gotten attacked by its own vending machines. PHP leads the future in upgrading its built-in crypto library. There's a very slick high-end Linux hack that I'm not going to promote, but I did want to bring it to the attention of our major Linux people because it's very cool. We have the rise of file-less malware. Some good advice for tax time, which gave me an opportunity to revise a recommendation I had recently made in error. An observation that it's not only Android's pattern lock that's vulnerable to casual visual eavesdropping. Also, a cautionary note of what happens when you store a huge pile of Samsung Note 7s in one place. A little bit of fun miscellany, a must not miss science fiction TV series we've discussed before. I failed to bring it up last week, and then, well, because I hadn't started into season two, and oh my goodness, it's just amazing. And then we will wrap up talking about some surprising revelations about just how bad TLS interception has become, not only because of its prevalence, but also, as always, the devil is in the details, and the devil's been busy.
Oh, boy. That'd be a good title for a show sometime. The devil's been busy. He's been busy. Well, before the devil gets busy with your data, let's take a break and we'll talk about Carbonite Online Backup and then back to all the latest security news. Our show brought to you by those good folks at Carbonite, who they've been sponsors since the very beginning. They're the best backup solution out there for people who don't want to think about backup, who don't want to plan, or, you know, they don't want to lose their data. That's all. Carbonite lets you stop worrying and start backing up almost instantly. Keep your business safe this year from ransomware, from hacker attacks, with automatic backup to the cloud. Look, I always say, and I stole this from my friend Peter Krogh, great photographer, and his 3-2-1 backup. There's certain things that good backup does. 3-2-1 backup's easy way to remember. It's two different kinds of media. I think that's it. Three copies of everything. And that means if you delete the original, is that right, John? Did I get that right? Three copies of everything. If you delete the original, that doesn't mean you have three copies anymore, right? So three copies of everything. Two different media. So don't put all your eggs in the CD-ROM basket. But most importantly, one of those three copies should be off-site. So if the worst happens, there's a fire or flood or somebody steals everything, your data is still safe, and that's exactly what Carbonite does. It's got plans for home and office, for Mac and PC. It's always affordable, flat rate pricing, so you don't have to worry about, you don't have to meter your bandwidth. You can store as much data as you've got. And by the way, we mentioned ransomware. Let me just point you to, if you go to carbonite.com, click the For Office tab, and go to the resources section. They have a lot of great posts there of all sorts of stuff, including how to create a disaster recovery plan, comply with HIPAA regulations, and there's a whole white paper on how to avoid getting bit by the worst threat out there from a business point of view, ransomware. Carbonite protects you because it does versioned backup on the cloud. So even if you get bit by ransomware, you can get back to work right away. Start your free trial today, carbonite.com. You do not need a credit card, but you will want this, the offer code, SecurityNow. One word, SecurityNow, because that's going to give you 2 months free when you buy. Protect your most valuable asset, your business data, your home data, with carbonite.com. Try it free, no credit card needed. But use the offer code SecurityNow for 2 months free with purchase. You got to back it up to get it back. Do it right with Carbonite. Okay, you got a good picture of the week? You want me to show that?
The best picture of all time.
Okay.
This is the funniest thing I have ever seen in my life.
I'm looking at it. Oh, I get it. Oh, my God. Should we see if people get it just by looking at it?
Oh, yes. It's just too wonderful.
What's happening here? So it's a motor of a generator. It looks like.
Yeah, we have a gas. It looks like a gasoline powered generator that's sitting on a elevated grid. And then there's this green solid copper wire, you know, I mean green insulated, but you can tell it's solid copper, that comes out and then wraps several times around a pole, like a long rod, which is shoved into a half-filled pail, a plastic pail of dirt.
Do you get it, Burke? Do you get what that is, Burke? Burke's shaking his head. Yeah, I know what that is. Maybe it'll help you if instead of calling it dirt, you call that a pail filled with ground.
Uh-huh.
Oh man. A grounding wire? I don't think so.
Oh, I just love this. Now, I mean, as with anything on the internet, you're tempted to think, okay, this is just, you know, this is a setup. But it's just so adorable.
John says we do that with all our racks. We got buckets of dirt all around.
That's right. You need to hook your ground wire to a stake, you know, pounded into the ground. And here's a half-filled plastic bucket of dirt.
This is hysterical.
God. It's just wonderful. Anyway, so whoever I wish I could remember who tweeted this to me. I saw it yesterday. I said, this is the best thing I've ever seen.
Oh my God.
And just, you know, it needs no explanation. I tweeted it late last night when I was putting this all together, and I got a great bunch of response from people of you know, a bunch of humorous responses from people who got it. And it's just, oh.
Well, this is a great little test to see if people understand electrical power, or if they're geeks. I think a geek would get this, right? If they look at it and they go, what do you mean? What's wrong with that?
Yeah, you got to parse it a little bit visually, right? And go, okay, wait, what's going on here? And then you sort of follow the green wire over to the rod that's stuck into a plastic pail. It's like, okay, well, this is not what we really had in mind when we were saying you need to ground the generator. Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, so Microsoft announced today the Microsoft Security dated February 2017, their formal announcement on Valentine's Day today, 2/14. Microsoft research security team said, our top priority is to provide the best possible experience for customers in maintaining and protecting their systems. This month, we discovered a last-minute issue that could impact some customers.
Showstopper. That's a showstopper.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
And was not resolved in time for our planned updates today.
Wow.
After considering all options, we made the decision to delay this month's updates. We apologize for any inconvenience caused by this change to the existing plan. Wow. Now, we don't know. Now, okay, ours believes this is the SMB. I mean, they're stating, and so maybe they have some other channel reporting that, because I haven't
seen. That was a big bug we talked about last week.
Yes, yeah. This is the server message block problem, which is a 0-day, because Microsoft, after being given 90 days to patch the flaw, never responded to the security researcher, Laurent Gaffey, who told them about this more than 3 months ago. And so he went public with a proof of concept written in Python, very nicely written, actually. You need to essentially pretend to be an SMB that is a server message block server. So he wrote an SMB server in Python, and the idea is that at the minimum, you can crash a Windows system. This is any 8.1 or 10. Also, server 2012 and 2016. So you need to arrange to get one of those to reach out to an SMB server. The problem is, historically, there have been many ways to get a browser to do that, and that's all it would take to bring your system down. And US CERT has been concerned that because the SMB client runs in the kernel, that would mean if this could be matured from a crash into a remote code execution, then it would be possible to run a remote attacker's code in the kernel, which is as bad as it gets. So we don't know this is why it's delayed. And I'm a little suspicious because this should not be a hard problem to solve. Unless I never took the time to dig into the nature of this exploit. But, you know, if it's just something that's easily patchable, it should have been easily patched months ago because this is a bad problem. So maybe the delay is for some other reason. We were expecting this, however, to certainly be fixed on, you know, on this Tuesday's today's update, and we don't have an update today. Mm-hmm. So
that's why
we don't know.
Yep.
It certainly, you know, follows. Safari on Mac OS gets uBlock Origin.
I was just talking about that this morning. I wasn't sure if it did.
Yep, it doesn't.
Interesting.
And I also heard you mentioning that your Chromebook immediately when it synchronized got its updates, that came in.
Yeah.
So for our listeners who don't know, we did a podcast number 523. So here we are at, 599? So that was more than a year ago. I think it was like maybe September of 2016, something like that. Anyway, it's podcast number 523 for those who don't know and want to go back and bring themselves fully up to speed. I was a holdout for NoScript, which is what I've been using for years. But it was just becoming too big a problem to have scripting disabled by default. So the big change for me was dropping NoScript and switching to uBlock Origin. We have full coverage in 523, but I'll just mention that it has now for a long time been supported by the Chromium-based browsers, meaning Chrome and Opera, by the Firefox-based browsers. So Firefox on Android, SeaMonkey, Pale Moon, and anything else derived from Firefox. Firefox does support an extra feature in uBlock Origin, which is not available in the Chromium browsers just because they lack the required feature in the API, which is script tag filtering, which is, as Gorhill says, is of great help to foil attempts by many websites to circumvent ad blockers. So this prevents circumvention. There is a Debian apt-get build that someone named Sean Whitten has produced for Debian 9 and later and Ubuntu 16.04 and later, which makes it very easy to add that to Linux. It's also supported under Microsoft's Edge. Until now, has not been available for Safari on Mac OS. It is now. It's available for download on GitHub. You might want to give it a few weeks to settle and stabilize because it's very new. But essentially, Gorhill takes exception to us calling it an ad blocker. He says it is not an ad blocker. It is a wide spectrum blocker, which happens to be able to function as he puts it, a mere ad blocker as well. The default behavior of uBlock Origin when newly installed is to block ads, trackers, and malware sites. And it strongly leverages the publicly curated lists, easy list, easy privacy, Peter Lowe's ad tracking malware servers and various lists of malware sites and its own filter lists. And he deliberately does not take donations, but he says if you want to, if you feel compelled to support this, then support the teams that are doing this list building, because you know that's a public social service essentially, which his engine uses to drive its selections. So anyway, it's great to see it come to Safari, and it's funny, I've been running for a while, I just sort of not noticed that I didn't have any blocker on my iOS Safari until I hit a site a couple days ago that was just intolerably obnoxious with ads. And I thought, don't I have one blocker turned on? And it turns out I had, for some reason, I turned it off. Probably some site was saying, oh, please don't block us. And I thought, okay, fine. Anyway, I turned it back on because it was just like, it was impossible to use this site. They were like bouncing windows jumping around in front of me. I said, okay, this is just ridiculous. So uBlock Origin is what we now recommend. And obviously, you, Leo, you have remained a fan of it.
I still use it, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm mixed, you know, mixed feelings about using an ad blocker, but at least on the air, I don't think it's inappropriate for me to keep that on, you know.
Well, and unfortunately, malvertising has become a thing.
Yeah.
And so it's almost a defensive deal. I mean, I'm a supporter of the Google contributor system, and we reported that they were going to be taking it down and then bringing it back up again. And I'm happy to do that. When I browse a site and I see, I have mine set to show those little pastel circles kind of moving around, and I see a page covered with rectangles that look like that. I think, okay, good. I've given some money to this site. I'm visiting it, and that seems like a reasonable trade-off. So it would be nice if that sort of thing,
Google stopped it, by the way. Did you? I don't know if you noticed the Google contributor thing is down, but I think that's preparatory to a bigger rollout, I would guess.
Yes,
like, and you want to do more, right? Yeah,
correct.
Yeah,
correct. We're not exactly sure how they're going to change it or what they're going to do, but they did, and they haven't said when, but they said, we just want to let you know, we're shutting it down. Any unused balance will be returned to you and we'll be coming back in the future. So it seems like a strange thing to do. Like, okay, why go through this dead period? But, I'm sure they have their.
I'll tell you why. Google.
Yeah.
It's just weird.
Exactly. Exactly. So this is an interesting story, and it's just so apropos to everything we've been talking about recently. We don't know what university this happened to, but this appeared in a Verizon four-page brag sheet about, their involvement in this. But it was really interesting. And it was written in a first-person narrative format that I'll just share as is, although I've edited it a little bit. So it reads, senior members of my university's IT security team rotate weekly as on-call incident commanders, as they're called at the university, in the event that a response is needed. This week was my turn, and as I sat at home, my phone lit up with a call from the help desk. They'd been receiving an increasing number of complaints from students all across campus about slow or inaccessible network connectivity. As always seemed to happen, the help desk had written off earlier complaints, and it was well after 9 p.m. when I was finally pulled in. I joined the conference bridge and began triaging the information. Even with limited access, the help desk had found a number of concerns. The name servers, responsible for domain name service lookups, were producing high volume alerts and showed an abnormal number of subdomains related to seafood. As the servers...
What?
Yeah. Seafood subdomains. You know, sushi dot something okay. dot something. As the servers struggled to keep up, legitimate lookups were being dropped. So this was a classic bandwidth flood or you know, server flood denial of service, where the servers were being overwhelmed with seafood subdomains, and so legitimate queries couldn't get their IPs resolved. So this was preventing access to the majority of the internet. While this explained the slow network issues, it raised much more concerning questions. From where were all these unusual DNS lookups coming? And why were there so many of them? Were students suddenly interested in seafood dinners? Seemed unlikely. Suspecting the worst, he writes, put on a coffee pot and got to work. Now that I had a handle on the incident in general, I began collecting and examining network and firewall logs. The firewall analysis identified over 5,000 discrete systems making hundreds of DNS lookups, that is, within their internal campus network. Of these, nearly all systems were found to be living on the segment of the network dedicated to our IoT infrastructure. Okay, now, so first there's a little bit of good news. The good news is they have a segment of their network dedicated to their IoT infrastructure, meaning they have a segmented network, which of course is what we've also been talking about on this podcast now for some months, is the need to give your IoT devices their own network segment. So when this happens, you have some control. And also so that when they get taken over, not if, when, then they'll be blind to the more important portion of your network. So he continues, with a massive campus to monitor and manage, everything from walkway light bulbs to vending machines had been connected to the network for ease of management and improved efficiencies. While these IoT systems were supposed to be isolated from the rest of the network, it was clear that they were configured to use DNS servers in a different subnet. So that's interesting. So they were on their own segment, but DNS had not been isolated. So so this little mistake in isolation allowed the problem on the IoT segment to essentially bring down the rest of the campus. So there's an interesting data point. Of the thousands of domains requested, only 15 distinct IP addresses were returned. Four of these IP addresses and close to 100 of the domains appeared in recent indicator lists for an emerging IoT botnet. So what they found was they'd been infected by an emerging IoT botnet. This botnet was known to spread from device to device by brute forcing default and weak passwords. Once the password was known, the malware had full control of the device and would check in with command infrastructure for updates and change the device's password, then locking us out of those 5,000 devices. This was a mess, he writes. Short of replacing every soda machine and lamppost, I was at a loss for how to remediate the situation. And really, you know, Think about it. They have 5,000 devices that have been commandeered, taken over, and had their passwords replaced. So this is not a small, I mean, like, this is the kind of thing that is actually happening now. And, I mean, as he says, how do you remediate this? How do you fix this? He continues, we had known repeatable processes and procedures for replacing infrastructure and application services, but nothing for an IoT outbreak. Fortunately, a less drastic option existed than replacing all the IoT devices on campus. Analysis of previous malware samples had shown that the control password used to issue commands to infected systems also was used as the newly updated device password. These commands were typically received via HTTP and in many cases did not rely on SSL to encrypt the transmissions. If this was the case for our compromise, a full packet capture could be used to inspect the network traffic and identify the new device's, plural, times 5,000, password. So the plan was to intercept the clear text password for a compromised IoT device over the wire and then use that information to perform a password change before the next malware update. If conducted properly and quickly, we could regain control of our IoT devices. You know, at this point, I'd be holding my breath and crossing everything, all my body parts, fingers and toes and everything else, that this might work. While we waited for the full packet capture solution, I instructed the network operations team to prepare to shut down all network access for our IoT segments once we had intercepted the malware password. Short-lived as it was, the impact from serving all of our IoT devices from the internet during that brief period of time was noticeable across the campus, and we were determined to never have a repeat incident. With the packet device underway, it was only a matter of hours before we had a complete listing of new passwords assigned to newly compromised devices. With these passwords, one of our developers was able to write a script which allowed us to log in and update the password and remove the infection across all devices at once. Whereupon I'd be going, whew. The whole process took a matter of minutes, and I made a mental note to save that script for later, although I prayed we would never need it again. Now that the incident had been contained, we looked towards ways to prevent it from happening again. So, lessons learned. Don't keep all your eggs in one basket. Create separate network zones for IoT systems. Air gap them from other critical networks where possible. Don't allow direct ingress and egress connectivity to the internet. Don't forget the importance of an inline proxy or content filtering system. So essentially, retrospectively, they're wishing that they had already had a device in place that was already filtering all of their IoT traffic. They ended up installing that in order to obtain visibility into this IoT segment that then allowed them to capture the password and perform the remediation, and also to take it off the internet so that they were able to fix all of the compromised devices in isolation. And then they also change default credentials on devices, use strong and unique passwords for device accounts and Wi-Fi networks, regularly monitor, and this is where most people fall down, regularly monitor events and logs. Hunt for threats at endpoints as well as the network level. Scan for open remote access protocols to your network and disable commonly unused and unsecured features and services. That's, of course, broadly good advice that aren't being required. And include IoT devices, and this is difficult, in IT asset inventory, because there are going to be so many of them. You know, this university had 5,000 of these things. You know, they had all of their vending machines plugged into the internet in order to support and improve management. So an interesting and I thought really fascinating story. And of course, it applies on a much smaller degree to end users, to listeners of this podcast, because as I've said, you know, we really do need to go to the effort to isolate the IoT devices. Clearly, we're headed towards a world where we've got devices that, for their functionality, need to be on the internet. You just don't want their compromise to be able to then compromise the rest of your network.
You still recommending the Ubiquiti Edge Router X as a way to do that? Okay, good. Somebody called the radio show this weekend and asked, and I said, yeah, as far as I know, this is still a very good way to go. Take some you have to know what you're doing. You get on the web interface and you have to know how to set up a VLAN and stuff, but at least it lets you do it with a $50-$60 router.
$49.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's four or five ports, and you know, true isolation where you're able. So you know, it is a router where instead of being a router connected to a switch, it is a router where every one of those ports is a separate Ethernet interface that can be given its own network. So you can have 192.0.x on one port, 192.1.x on another port, 192.2.x on a third port, and those networks cannot see each other. They are isolated. So it's a fabulous and very cost-effective solution. But as you say, Leo, at this point, you really do need to sit down and you know, figure out networking. There are a lot of how-tos on the network, and I'm sure that the drive toward IoT and the problem with its security is going to end up with people coming up with a drop-in solution. You know, if I didn't already have my plate over full, I'd have some online configuration stuff for the Ubiquiti router, but I'll just because other people can do that too. Those things are being created on the internet. So PHP 7.2, it just got voted to add libsodium to the core standard library.
Wow, yes. That's interesting.
Yes, last week the voting phase closed on an RFC to add libsodium to PHP 7.2. The result was unanimous, 37 in favor, 0 against. Now, there was a much more split vote. In looking at it visually, I couldn't visually see, it looked to me like it was about 50-50. That is, the question was whether to keep the existing API namespace, it's like /sodium/something, or to, with this change, to bind it into the root namespace, and they decided to do that. That did win. So it'll be, and I don't remember, I remember seeing it, but I don't remember what it was. But so it won't be down a hierarchy. It'll be in the root namespace. And so it's going to be built in. Libmcrypt is what PHP has had since 2007. So for nearly 10 years. And that left only OpenSSL as a viable option for PHP 5.x and 7.0 up to this point. So, of course, by comparison, Libsodium is, as we know, it's my favorite library. It's the one that that I've used functions from for Squirrel. We're seeing it being adopted pervasively across the industry. Because it's a modern state-of-the-art crypto library offering authenticated encryption, high-speed elliptic curve, crypto, and, you know, all the features that you want. So, you know, unlike other crypto standards, which basically are a potluck of various crypto primitives, for example, like web crypto, Libsodium is comprised of carefully selected algorithms implemented by true security experts to avoid side channel vulnerabilities, to offer short keys with high security, and as a toolkit, there was effort made in its design to prevent people from doing the wrong things. There aren't, unlike OpenSSL, where there are about 25 different ways to do something, there's one way to do something in Libsodium, and it's the right way. So, you know, don't make it up. Just call the function, and it'll keep you from hurting yourself. So, you know, bravo for the PHP team for doing this. And we're not going to see it immediately. It's going to be later, toward the end of this year. But 7.2, when available, will have it built in. And that's just, you know, a great step forward. Okay, so this is not for the faint of heart, but I wanted to put it on the radar of our Linux users, because I know we have a huge Linux following in the podcast. This is a script called takeover.sh. It's up on GitHub. I've got the link to it. It's github.com/Marcan, M-A-R-C-A-N, the guy who did this, /takeover.sh. He describes it as takeover.sh is a shell script to completely take over a running Linux system remotely via SSH without rebooting, allowing you to log into an in-memory rescue environment, unmount the original root file system, and do anything you want, all without rebooting. You could even replace one distro with another without touching a physical console. So, and he warns people. He says, this is experimental. Do not use this script if you don't understand exactly how it works. Do not use this script on any system you care about. Do not use this script on any system you expect to be up. Do not run this script unless you can afford to get physical access to fix a botched takeover. If anything goes wrong, your system will most likely panic. That said, this script will not itself, he writes, make any permanent changes to your existing root file system, assuming you run it from the temp file system. So long as you can remotely reboot your box using an out-of-band mechanism, you should be okay. But don't blame me, he writes, if it eats your dog. This script does not have any provisions for exiting out of the new environment back into something sane. You will have to reboot when you're done. If you get anything wrong, your machine won't boot. Tough luck. This is not a guide for newbies. He writes, I'm deliberately not giving you commands you can copy and paste. You know, there's no curl where you click the link on a web page. If you can't figure out, he writes, what to do exactly without handholding, this script is not for you. But anyway, I thought it was cool. This would allow somebody who knows what they're doing to SSH into a system and essentially on the fly switch from the mounted boot file system into an in-RAM temporary file system, and so much so that you are then able to unmount your normal operating boot file system for whatever reason you may have and perform surgery at a much deeper level than you normally could, and then finally reboot the system, and if you've done everything right, have it come up under its new configuration. Anyway, I just thought it was very cool. Scary, but for people who are seriously into Linux, I could see where there could be an application for it. So I wanted to put it on our high-end Linux users' radar. Dan Gooden, writing for Ars Technica, covered a story that comes out of Kaspersky that I thought was interesting, and it indirectly affects us because we've been seeing the Mirai botnet, where just rebooting devices gets control back, and this sort of shows us an interesting trend as a consequence of the fact that there are more and more internet-connected things that do not routinely reboot, like your refrigerator or the Coke machine or whatever. So Dan writes, 2 years ago, researchers at Moscow-based Kaspersky Lab discovered their corporate network, Kaspersky, was infected with malware that was unlike anything they had ever seen. Virtually all the malware resided solely in the memory of the compromised computers. And by the way, we did cover this at the time, but since then we're seeing a trend. A feat on the side of this malware that allowed the infection to remain undetected for 6 months or more. Kaspersky eventually unearthed evidence that Dooku 2.0, as the never-before-seen malware was dubbed, was derived from Stuxnet, the highly sophisticated computer worm reportedly created by the U.S. and Israel to sabotage Iran's nuclear program, which, of course, we covered extensively at the time, to spin their centrifuges up to a speed that would cause them to self-destruct. Now, fileless malware is going mainstream as financially motivated criminal hackers mimic their nation-sponsored counterparts. According to research, Kaspersky Lab plans to publish Wednesday, networks belonging to at least 140 banks and other enterprises have been infected by malware that relies on the same in-memory design to remain nearly invisible. And think about it. You know, we detect malware by looking for it on mass storage. This is deliberately not storing itself where it can be scanned. It's in RAM, and we're not good yet at finding that. Because infections are so hard to spot, the actual number is likely much higher. Another trait that makes the infections hard to detect is the use of legitimate and widely used system administrative and security tools, including PowerShell, Metasploit, and Mimikatz, to inject the malware into computer memory. And in fact, it turns out that it was actually PowerShell. Well, I'm sure we'll cover this because I'll have more details about this next week after having a chance to to take a look at what Kaspersky has provided. What's interesting here, writes Kaspersky's expert Kurt Baumgartner, is that these attacks are ongoing globally against banks themselves. The banks have not been adequately prepared in many cases to deal with this. He went on to say that people behind the attacks are pushing money out of the banks from within the banks by targeting computers that run ATMs, automatic teller machines. The 140 unnamed organizations that have been infected reside in 40 different countries, with the U.S., France, Ecuador, Kenya, and the U.K. being the top five most affected nations. The Kaspersky Lab researchers still don't know if a single group of individuals is behind the attacks or if they're being carried out by competing hacker gangs. The use of the fileless malware and command server domains that aren't associated with any Whois data makes the already difficult task of attribution nearly impossible. So, in general, we're seeing a rise in this kind of in-memory compromise. It may be, in many cases, that firmware may not be safely writable on these machines or can't even contain the malware. Like, you know, as we know, our IoT devices tend to be memory lean, only having enough firmware space to contain their own OS. So they just, you know, there may be no space for that. So the malware lives opportunistically in RAM, hoping to stay there for as long as it can. And many of these IoT devices are appliances that are rarely, if ever, power cycled. And of course, servers typically remain up between their patch cycles if they don't crash. So malware that is scanning and is able to infect on the fly is able to take up residence until the system is updated and then rebooted after a patch cycle. And as we know, some routers, whether big iron or consumer little blue box routers, they may be up for years at a time with something living in them in RAM. So it's interesting because, as we know, scanning the device's file systems will reveal nothing because this stuff is no longer in files. It's arriving over the connectedness of the device and just taking up residence. Interesting. And here's where I wanted to correct myself. This was a really nice blog posting that brought to my attention that I had referred to AxCrypt recently when I meant AES-Crypt as the recommended encryption utility. Remember, I was talking about email last week and saying, you know, like, just if you really care about the security of something you're sending to someone, TNO, you need to use the same protocol that we use for storing data, our data in the cloud, where or PIE, as we've also called it, pre-internet encryption, where you encrypt it before you let the internet have it. Anyway, this nice blog posting was titled "Encrypt Your Tax Documents Before You Send Them." And this person wrote, "It's that time. We're all doing our taxes online now. Some of us need some help, and that usually ends up with digitally sending tax documents. Do not ever," they write, "under any circumstance, email a document that has your social security number, home address, phone number, bank information, etc., unencrypted. That's a good way to lose all of your money and even your identity." He writes, "I'm going to use two free services to send my encrypted documents out. AES Crypt and Dropbox. Step one, install AES Crypt. Get AES Crypt installed on your computer. Go here and install your platform. And I'll follow up with details here in a second. Two, zip all of those files. You want to send one encrypted blob of data. And I'm happy to see him use the word blob. After all, I wonder if he's a listener to Security Now. After all of your files, put all of your files into a single folder and zip that up. On the Mac, select the file and go to File, Compress, Sensitive Docs. Step three, encrypt. Follow the directions for your platform to encrypt your zip file. On the Mac, drag the file onto the doc icon and enter a strong password when prompted. I suggest, he writes, using a secure password generator. Oh, I think he is a listener. Like the one over at grc.com.
Oh, well, there you go.
You can also use LastPass or whatever you use to manage your passwords. Make a note of that password, though. You can keep a copy of the password in TextEdit or NavAlt. The documents are already on your computer. Step four, drop it into Dropbox. Using Dropbox makes sharing files easy. Put the encrypted file into your Dropbox folder and click Share Link. You can send them the file directly through the Dropbox website or get the link and send it separately. Step five, send the password via a separate method. Yes, if you send an email with the link to your encrypted document, it doesn't make sense to put the password into that email. Additionally, you might not want to send the password from your account to that same account. Try to send the password over iMessage, Signal, or another instant messenger, or to a secondary email address the person has. You could also, and this is what I would do, make the password something you could read to them over the phone. Now, this person suggests uppercase J, lowercase Z, 6-5, and so forth. I would prefer a numeric, long numeric password grouping the numbers in pairs, because it's very easy to say 35, 27, 42, 56. That's acoustically unambiguous. You get a pair of digits per utterance. And so if you just take a long numbers only password, and of course you can have LastPass do that for you. You just tell it that you want numbers only and they'll say okay, and then put spaces, and that's easy then to read over the phone to the other person. And then step six, this blogger writes, the takedown. Once the recipient has confirmed that they have the documents and have decrypted them on their own machine, remove the encrypted documents from Dropbox. Sure, they're safe, he writes, but there's no reason to keep them online. So, about AES Crypt, I recently referred to Axe Crypt, actually just last week, in this context, when I meant to say AES Crypt. We've spoken about it before, and I just got my tongue tied. Axe Crypt was what I used to recommend, but it has gone commercial. And against all reason, they have a subscription plan, a few dollars a month or more per year. It just makes no sense to me at all that you'd have a subscription plan for an encryption utility. So bye-bye, Axe Crypt. Hello, AES Crypt. The website is AESCRYPT.com. It is free, open source, multi-platform, available on Windows, Mac, Linux, iOS, Android, and also for PHP and Java. So that's what you want to use. It is drop dead simple. And as we know, AES is a good strong cipher. So you simply give it a good key. It'll use that key to encrypt your document, and then send it any way you want to. You could certainly do this, and I presume this blogger is suggesting to use Dropbox because it can handle large things easier than email. But if it's not too large, then you could also just mail it to someone. But again, you do want to arrange to pass the shared secret key through some secure means. And again, I like making it very long, numeric only, chop them up into digit pairs, and then just dictate it over the phone, which is very easy to do.
This post kind of makes me sad, I'll be honest with you. PGP does all of this, and it does it better, and it does it right, and there's PGP key exchange servers that work very well and very reliably, and it's public key crypto, not symmetric crypto, which you're using here. Nothing wrong with this solution, but here's an opportunity to get more people to use PGP or GPG, which is in the long run a far better solution. My opinion. Just throwing that in. AES script's fine, but why not use GPG? You have this. You don't have to worry about the symmetric key exchange because you have public key crypto. The problem is, of course, it's difficult to set up. But that's my issue. Is I think fragmenting the market is not the right solution. The right solution is get everybody using PGP. People at Keybase are doing a great job of making PGP very accessible, very easy. They have a key server, I would say it's arguably more secure because you don't have the symmetric key exchange involved.
They are abandoning it though.
Who's abandoning what?
Keybase is abandoning PGP.
No, that's not true. They're doing a chat. Well, you know more about this than I do probably, but I'm using their encrypted chat, but that's not using a GPG key. But your absolutely use your GPG key there. Their Keybase is still a GPG or PGP key server, and that's the main purpose of it. They're not abandoning it. They're just not using it in their chat solution.
Well, they're abandoning it in the future.
Are they? Is that what they said?
Yes.
Well, that's disappointing.
Yeah. Well, I don't think PGP ever worked. I mean, you and I differ on this. I just think the hurdle is too big, and we need to reduce the hurdle.
Well, is there another better way to do public key?
It's on its way. Yeah. Libsodium is all public key.
Right. Somebody's pointing out in the chat room that, you probably should be working with a CPA that supports HTTPS file uploads in the first place. If your CPA is asking you to email your tax records, that's probably not CPA to use.
And I like this more as a generic solution because it's not just your CPA, it's anybody you want to send something.
It's good for people to know about AES Crypt. Yeah, I agree. But I don't think a symmetric key solution is – I think that adds, some fundamental problems. And I think we got public key crypto. Let's make it easier to use. Let's figure out a way to make it easier to use.
Yeah, yeah.
Just my two cents. You're the expert. I'm just throwing that in.
No, I don't disagree. Okay, so Sam Cox tweeted me an observation that just hadn't occurred to me when we were talking about the Android pattern lock. And he said, numeric passcodes are also entered on a 3x3 grid. So, I guess technically 3x4, but so he said, so aren't they also vulnerable to the Android pattern lock attack? And it's like, yes, come to think of it, they are. Because the whole point of that was that you have limited spatial resolution on a large grid. And what you're looking at is relative motion. And so the pattern lock the pattern lock attack exactly attacks a low resolution keypad grid in exactly the same way. So, bravo, Sam, for that observation. I thought that was great. And Leo, The second picture of that we have here in the show notes is just sort of sad. You know, snarky as always, the Register called – theregister.co.uk called this a touching Note 7 tribute, which was the Samsung battery factor – the battery factory, which spontaneously burst into flame.
Oh, Lord.
Now, the good news is nobody was hurt. And you know, my takeaway was just sort of shaking my head. It was when you are recalling a huge number of batteries because they are prone to spontaneous combustion, it would be best not to store them in what amounts to a large, and this is my term, Fukushima pile.
Yeah.
You know, it's just
this is actually where they're recycling the Note 7 batteries,
yes,
right?
Yes, right, right. So they say, so, you know, they're like all being returned, and they had this was the recycling facility. And unfortunately, I mean, maybe they just couldn't get to them all. I mean, you know, clearly, you know, I did a lot of travel. When was it? I guess over the holidays. And without fail, every single gate that you're at, the attendants are reminding us now, if you have a Note 7, you need to just, you know, not bring it on the plane because you can't do that. So, but think about it, Leo. I mean, think about how many of them there were that none of them are trusted, yet the battery has to be taken apart. I mean, it needs to be the device needs to be opened and the battery needs to be unwrapped because essentially it was wrapped over itself and the corners were bent and it was just manufacturing problems. But I never really thought about the problem of disposing of these.
Well, we had talked about this on the new Screensavers with Kyle Weens of iFixit. He says he doesn't know of a recycling factory that hasn't had a lithium ion battery fire. This
is
very common because if you puncture a lithium ion battery in air,
if you breach it,
it will burst into flame. And he says this is the real problem with these batteries that, you know, everybody's using now that are not in a protective shield. They're very hard to recycle. And he said everybody has fires. This is universal now.
Yeah.
So you got to be, I guess you're prepared about that, right?
Yeah. Let's take a break.
And we'll be back with more of Security Now in just a moment. Let me put the Audible logo up so you know this is an ad. Because I could see how you'd be easily confused that since we talk about Audible all the time, I talk about it all the time, this could be editorial. But no, this part's the ad part, although I am a huge Audible fan. I've been an Audible member since 2000. And I first became an Audible member because I was driving to Tech TV. And while nominally that's an hour from Petaluma, an hour each way is 2 hours a day of reading, it was often 4 hours a day of reading. And if it was just 4 hours a day of listening to light rock, less talk, I'd have been crazy by now. Thank God I found audiobooks. And once I found audiobooks, and that was in early, you know, late 90s, and it was a pain because they would send you a box of cassettes that you had to return at the end of the month. Audible came around 2000. I joined Audible in 2000, 16 years ago. And you keep the book. You don't have to return it. You don't have to listen to it in 1 month, which is good because I like long books. And I now have, in fact, I'll show you in my Audible library, I've got hundreds of books that I can go back and listen to at any time. I often do. In fact, if you look at my library, and I just posted my 2016 listens on my blog, leolaporte.com/blog. If you look at the list of books, you'll see there's a whole bunch of these Aubrey Maturin series books by Patrick O'Brien. You like Honor Harrington.
Yes.
Spacefarer. I like to go back to the early 1800s in the Napoleonic Wars. Patrick O'Brien's seafaring novels about Captain Aubrey and his best friend, Stephen Maturin, are amazing. There are 21 of them, and I own almost all of them. I had, I still have about three more to get on Audible because I listened to a lot of these on cassette at first. So I'm slowly completing because I want to have all 21. I don't know why complete. I don't know. I love these. If you haven't listened to them yet, start with Master and Commander. You remember that movie It's a wonderful movie, but really that's just the beginning of an amazing voyage. Incidentally, the reader that they use on these, I'm just going to play a little bit of it. I think I played it before. There are two different readers, but if you can, always get the Patrick Tull versions. He's passed away, as has Patrick O'Brien, the author, so there aren't going to be any more. This is it. But he has such a great voice for this.
Present, he had taken the liveliest pleasure in beauty. And this spirited girl, half standing and all alive with excitement, was absurdly beautiful.
There's nobody better.
But now he only observed the fact.
By the way, now you may say, well, that's weird. But see, here's the thing. It takes a little bit. But once you get used to it, like, you can't listen to these books with anybody else. That's how perfect it is. And that's true of a lot of Audible books. Audible is the biggest bookstore in the world. Wait a minute. I might have to listen to this. Lincoln in the Bardo, a novel by George Sanders of the afterlife, right? Abraham Lincoln in the afterlife. Oh, I got to get this. And look who does some of the narration. This is what one of the things Audible does that's so cool. They'll do dramatizations. So this isn't just read by the author. This just came out. Came out today. This is my problem with Audible. I'm hooked. But you're going to get one book free, so this could be a good one. But look at the narrators. Nick Offerman of Parks and Rec, Ron Swanson, David Sedaris, Carrie Brownstein, George Sanders is the author. Lena Dunham is in this, Ben Stiller, Susan Sarandon, Bradley Whitford. So they, Rainn Wilson, Jeff Tweedy? Wait a minute, of Wilco? Jeff Tweedy? Don Cheadle is in this, Patrick Wilson. This looks awesome. If you were thinking, oh, I can't listen to one person read a whole book, try one of these. Let me just listen a little bit.
Two. You know, Mrs. Lincoln said to me, the president is expected to give a series of state dinners every winter. And these dinners are there.
I gotta listen to this. I don't even know what it's about, but sounds wonderful. But this is it. See, it's like going into a great bookstore. Do you remember those days when they had bookstores? And you'd go in, and you'd browse.
The smell of them.
Yeah, yes. And I'd take home 20 books, a stack, right? Spend hundreds of dollars. Well, this is kind of like that. This just came out, Neil Gaiman's North Mythology. I'm seeing all these tweets from people saying, just in time for Valentine's Day, the gift I always wanted. Neil has the best voice. He is one of those authors who should read all of his books.
The Players. Many gods and goddesses are named in Norse mythology.
So imagine.
You'll meet quite a few of them in
these
pages.
You're stuck in traffic.
Most of the stories
driving
have,
home.
However, concern
and Neil
two
Gaiman
gods.
Is reading to you from his newest book. You won't mind that drive. In fact, I've done it, and I know many have, circled the block a few times before I get home because I don't want to finish the chapter. Here's the deal. Go to audible.com/security now. Ooh, this is the new HBO show coming out Sunday, Big Little Lies. Always read the book before the movie, right? Always. Yep. Here's your big problem. You got to choose one. Audible.com/security now. You'll be signing up for the gold subscription plan. That's the book a month. You also get the Daily Digest of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. And your first book's free. You cancel any time in the first 30 days. You pay nothing, although the book is yours. Ooh, James Corden has a book. May I have your attention, please? Narrated by the author.
I got onto my feet so that I was standing. And what I saw then, at that moment,
I almost wish I could just, like, not work and listen to audiobooks all the time. Well, anyway, you should listen a little bit. At least try it, right? Audible.com/security now. Your first book's free, but I gotta warn you, it may not be your last.
You'll get hooked.
See, you're not an audiobook guy, and I understand some people aren't. I completely understand that. It's fine with me.
Yeah.
But my eyes are tired. I'm sleepy at night. You can do this with your Echo. I turn on, I ask the Echo to read to me, and I'm lying in bed. I set up speakers, powered speakers in the bedroom just so I could listen. It's just fantastic. On we go. You've had your coffee. You've been caffeinated.
Recaffeinated. As opposed to decaffeinated. So a listener of ours shot me a tweet that I appreciated. He said, PF Sense allows one to activate UPnP and allow only user-specified IP addresses.
I like that.
Yes. On the LAN to open ports.
PF Sense, FTW.
Yep. And so that's a nice feature of PF Sense. And I logged into my PF Sense router because that's what I'm using, and right there on the PF Sense page on the UPnP page, the second section says UPnP access control lists, and it reads these entries control access to the UPnP service. Client systems may be granted or denied access based on several criteria, and so you then have, you know, a standard router style or firewall style access control list where you're able to specify which devices can or cannot use UPnP. So this is, again, for a higher end network environment, this is what you want, where you would sign a static IP, for example, to your Xbox based on its MAC address. That way it's always going to get the same IP because it's always going to – its interface, its Ethernet interface will always have the same MAC address. So you bind those together and then you give it alone access to Universal Plug and Play so it can handle – it has permission to handle its own mapping, but nothing else in your network is able to see that. And alternatively – you could use the network segmentation we were talking about because you're able to give access to a range of ports. So, for example, you could make your IoT segment able to use Universal Plug and Play, I mean, if you wanted to, yet the other devices on your network could not. So a lot of flexibility there. And there is – I meant to mention – a couple of months ago, there is a very nice little PF Sense box. It's red and it only has two ports. I wish it had more ports because you'd like to also be able to do network segmentation, although it does support VLANs. So if you had a VLAN capable switch, which they're inexpensive, then you could have the little cute red two-port PF Sense as your router and firewall, and then connect that to a VLAN-aware, inexpensive switch in order to then get multiple port segmentation in order to create a more powerful network. Anyway, we've got so many toys now to play with in our home networks, and you know none of them are very expensive. So anyway, thank you for reminding me that PF Sense supports ACLs. Okay, now I have the awful pun of the week, Leo. It's truly all
puns are awful, Steve.
Yes, I need to apologize profusely in advance. Now, in my defense, I grew up with a grandfather who lived to 103. Was the master punster of the world. And I've mentioned some of his favorites in the past. I think probably my all-time is I opened the window and influenza.
Yeah.
You know, that's
on Valentine's Day, the old Marx Brothers pun. When love comes in the door. No, let's see. Oh, shoot. When I come in the door, love goes innuendo. Something like that.
And he also, my grandfather used to say, if the rain keeps up, it won't come down. So anyway, with that understanding, many people saw this and sent it to me. I don't know where it originated, but so this one is, and of course, it's perfect for the podcast. You can't use beef stew as a password.
What?
It isn't stroganoff.
That's good. That is a good. No, that's good. For a pun, that ain't bad.
You can't use beef stew as a password.
Why not, Steve?
It isn't stroganoff.
Yeah, that transcends pun into wordplay, as Logan Five says. Yeah.
Yeah. And I do like wordplay, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very good. Now for our next one, we have metaphysics and Schrodinger's cat meets cryptography. Now, this is a little in the along the lines of, you know, the sound of one hand clapping or if a tree falls in the woods. So here it is, metaphysics. If you encrypt data with a key that is so strong that it would take more than all of the energy in the universe to crack, and the key is then destroyed, does the data continue to exist?
Oh, that's the old black hole conundrum.
Isn't that good? Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
That actually is kind of deep. That's what Stephen Hawking was debating, whether information it can exist inside a black hole.
Right. And so in this case, we have data which is encrypted using a key that would take more than all of the energy in the universe to decrypt. And then the key is destroyed. The question is, so does the data still exist? Don't know. And
so Groucho's quote, and I stand corrected. One of our chatters gave it to me. He said, oh, crap, I just lost it. Madam Swemsky says, I don't like this innuendo. Groucho says, that's what I always say. Love flies out the door when money comes innuendo. I like mine better. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. And finally, another follower and frequent tweeter friend of mine on Twitter said of the second season of Expanse, very realistic space combat makes Star Trek look very silly and childish. And I was thinking exactly the same thing. I didn't mention it last Tuesday because I hadn't yet started to watch the second season. I was two episodes behind, or maybe one, and then the other one came in on Wednesday. Oh my God, Leo. What I found myself thinking as I was watching this is I have only ever seen this in my mind when I am reading the best military sci-fi. There was some combat stuff in the first couple hours of the second season of The Expanse that is among the best I have ever – I've never seen it on the screen. I've only visualized it from reading it. So – and we talked about this last year. The Expanse is a stunning sci-fi series. It is now – the first season, for those who aren't – who didn't already see the first season, is now on Amazon Prime. So if you are an Amazon Prime subscriber, you can catch up and with the first season, which was excellent. It is just – it's the best science fiction on television without question. So – and the second – and I remember that we knew this was coming. I read all four of the first books because the books are always better. But boy, this – you know, this moved to the screen does not disappoint. So I just wanted to say to anybody else who thought, holy wow, I mean, this is just amazing television. Yes, I completely agree. And for anybody who's not watching it, first season on Amazon Prime, and you're only 2 weeks in to the second season, definitely worthwhile. And I did get a nice note from David Goldenberg. He said, hi, Steve. I've been a happy owner of SpinRite for a few years now. It's my secret weapon in the technology trenches. I am the family tech guy. I'm out at my kids' school, and I have my own part-time business fixing PCs, training, and networking. So, yes, he is in the crossfire. He says, SpinRite is always within reach and never lets me down. Last week, I've been preparing a laptop for a presentation for my Aries amateur radio group. I volunteered to get a new program running to send text messages and email type communications over the radio. After several days, I had everything working great and spent several hours getting screenshots for the PowerPoint I was to prepare. I was getting together with another ham to go over what I had and to get his machine working. So I started up my laptop and got the dreaded BSOD, which of course we know is blue screen of death, and an unmountable boot volume. I didn't break a sweat or even worry, as I knew from experience that SpinRite would save the day. And needless to say, 2 hours later, the drive scanned, several sectors were repaired, the laptop booted perfectly, and everything I needed was ready to go. You're great. Thanks. David Goldenberg, KJ6MCQ. And David, nice. You're great for sharing your experience. And I really appreciate that.
I like it.
And a ham, yes.
Are you a ham? I keep forgetting. Are you a ham?
I'm not.
You're not.
Never got into it.
Too analog for you, huh?
Well, yes. Yeah.
Well, you do some analog stuff. Your light pen was analog.
I do. It was, yes, indeed
it was.
In the
early days, yeah.
Yep.
But
yep.
Nowadays, ham has become as much digital as an analog. Really.
I mean, which I find really interesting.
Me too.
Yes,
the fact.
Okay, so.
Let's go. TLS.
A fabulous piece of work. This was a big team with members from the University of Michigan, University of Illinois, Mozilla, Cloudflare, Google, UC Berkeley, and the International Computer Science Institute. And when I just scanned their names, there are lots of people that I recognized there. This was a beautifully assembled paper. And I started to go through it, trying to sort of like pull excerpts from it. And I just couldn't stop finding stuff that was all relevant. So I'm going to share the abstract and the introduction, both which are just perfect. The abstract reads, as HTTPS development grows, corporate middle box, as they term, and corporate middle boxes are these, you know, these things, these appliances, which corporations are using to intercept their intranets HTTPS communications to the outside, and antivirus products, they write, are increasingly intercepting TLS connections to retain visibility into network traffic. In this work, we present a comprehensive study on the prevalence and impact of HTTPS interception. First, we show that web servers can detect interception by identifying a mismatch between the HTTP user agent header and TLS client behavior. And I inserted here my own observation. In other words, current TLS interceptors are not bothering to mask their presence, though they certainly could. Okay, so then they continue. We characterize the TLS handshakes of major browsers and popular interception products, which we use to build a set of heuristics to detect interception and identify the responsible product. We deploy heuristics at three large network providers: the Mozilla Firefox update servers, a set of popular e-commerce sites, and the Cloudflare content distribution network. We find more than an order of magnitude more interception than previously estimated, and with dramatic impact on connection security. To understand why security suffers, we investigate popular middle boxes and client-side security software, finding that nearly all reduce connection security, and many introduce severe vulnerabilities. Drawing on our measurements, we conclude with a discussion on recent proposals to safely monitor HTTPS and recommendations for the security community. That's the abstract. So I'll just now share just the introduction, because essentially this wraps up all of the meat of it. And then the rest of the paper, it's, I think it was 14 pages, is just details. And actually, it's all stuff that we've talked about in various contexts previously. So they write, when it comes to HTTPS, the security community is working at cross purposes. And we know this is true. On the one hand, they write, we are striving to harden and ubiquitously deploy HTTPS in order to provide strong end-to-end connection security. At the same time, middlebox and antivirus products increasingly intercept, i.e., terminate and reinitiate HTTPS connections in an attempt to detect and block malicious content that uses the protocol to avoid inspection. Previous work has found that some specific HTTPS interception products dramatically reduce connection security. However, the broader security impact of such interception remains unclear. In this paper, we conduct the first comprehensive study of HTTPS interception in the wild, quantifying both its prevalence in traffic to major services and its effects on real-world security. We begin by introducing a novel technique for passively detecting HTTPS interception based on handshake characteristics. HTTPS interception products typically function as transparent proxies. They terminate the browser's TLS connection themselves, inspect the HTTP plaintext, and relay the HTTP data over a new TLS connection to the destination server. We show that web servers can detect such interception by identifying a mismatch between the HTTP user agent header and the behavior of the TLS client. TLS implementations display varied support and preference order for cipher suites, extensions, elliptic curves, compression methods, and signature algorithms. In other words, sort of the metadata of the TLS connection varies from implementation to implementation, that allows that the target servers that are instrumented to detect those signatures. So they say, we characterize these variations for major browsers and popular interception products in order to construct heuristics for detecting interception and identifying the responsible product. Next, we assess the prevalence and impact of HTTPS interception by applying our heuristics to nearly 8 billion connection handshakes. So this was a comprehensive study, 8 billion connections. In order to avoid the bias inherent in any single network vantage point, we analyzed connections for 1 week at 3 major different internet services: the Mozilla Firefox update servers, a set of popular e-commerce websites, and the Cloudflare content distribution network. These providers serve different types of content and different populations of users, and we find differing rates of interception. 4% of Firefox update connections, 6.2% of e-commerce connections, and 10.9% of U.S. Cloudflare connections were intercepted. While these rates vary by vantage point, all are more than an order of magnitude higher than previous estimates. So think about that. Nearly 11% of U.S. Cloudflare connections, this is surprising, were being intercepted. To quantify the real-world security impact of the observed interception, we establish a grading scale based on the TLS features advertised by each client. By applying the metric to unmodified browser handshakes and to the intercepted connections seen at each vantage point, we calculate the change in security for intercepted connections. While some older clients' proxies increased connection security, meaning if you had an older client that was inherently low security, the running it through a TLS transparent proxy might actually increase its security because, for example, the client might be using RC4 and encryption and not offer anything stronger, whereas the proxy does. So the weak security connection would be kept local and the public connection would be stronger. So they say while some older clients' proxies increased connection security, these improvements were modest compared to the vulnerabilities, the new vulnerabilities introduced. 97% of Firefox, 32% of e-commerce, and 54% of Cloudflare connections that were intercepted were made less secure. Again, 97% of the connections to the Firefox update servers where you would like to have security because you're getting a new copy of Firefox that could be compromised. 54% of the connections to Cloudflare, of which 10.9% were intercepted, more than half of those had their security compromised by that interception. Alarmingly, not only did intercepted connections use weaker cryptographic algorithms, but between 10 and 40% advertised support for known broken ciphers that would allow an active man-in-the-middle attacker to later intercept, downgrade, and decrypt the connection data. A large number of these severely broken connections were due to network-based middle boxes rather than client-side, which is to say typically AV, security software. 62% of these middle box appliance connections were less secure, and an astounding 58% had severe vulnerabilities enabling later interception. Finally, we attempt to understand why such a large number of intercepted connections are vulnerable by testing the security of a range of popular corporate middle boxes, antivirus products, and other software known to intercept TLS. The default settings for 11 of the 12 corporate middle box appliances we evaluated expose connections to known attacks, and 5 of those 12 introduce severe new vulnerabilities, for example, incorrectly validated certificates. Similarly, 24 of the 26 client-side security AV products we tested introduced connection security. Reduce connection security, and 2/3 introduce severe vulnerabilities. That's 24 of the 26 client-side AV products. In some cases, manufacturers attempted to customize libraries or re-implement TLS, introducing negligent vulnerabilities. In other cases, products shipped with libraries that were years out of date. Across the board, companies are struggling to correctly deploy the base TLS protocol, let alone implement modern HTTPS security features. Our results indicate that HTTPS interception has become startlingly widespread, and that interception products as a class have a dramatically negative impact on connection security. We hope that shedding light on this state of affairs will motivate improvements to existing products, advance work on recent proposals for safely intercepting HTTPS, and prompt discussion on long-term solutions. I should mention that they also had a responsible disclosure where all of the vendors of these sweepingly insecure products were privately notified. The document, this 14-page PDF, has charts and tables showing devices which presumably have since been remediated, hopefully. But this really raises an interesting dilemma, and it's one for which there is not a clear solution. I mean, as the paper starts out, and as we said, the industry is at odds with itself because we are moving from plain text to secure tunnels, yet there is a legitimate need to protect from the ability for malicious content of all kinds to hide within those tunnels. Even, for example, if you're doing nothing but looking for credit card numbers and, you know, the exfiltration of sensitive corporate data, then you could argue any corporation has an obligation to do. But if all the connections are secure, it can't. So they had a couple takeaways. One was they said we need community consensus. There is little consensus within the security community on whether HTTPS interception is acceptable. Discussions over protocol features that facilitate safer interception have been met with great hostility within standards groups. These communities need to reach consensus on whether interception is appropriate in order to develop sustainable long-term solution. And then they also said antivirus vendors should reconsider intercepting HTTPS. Antivirus software operates locally and already has access to the local file system, browser memory, and any content loaded over HTTPS. Given their history of both TLS misconfigurations and remote code execution vulnerabilities, you know, we've talked about that the AV has started introducing a larger attack surface than the OS there it's trying to protect. Then they continue, we strongly encourage antivirus providers to reconsider whether intercepting HTTPS is responsible. And so the point they're making here is that instead of trying to get the data on the fly, wait till it arrives and put your hooks in there where you do have visibility. And I would say, as we did, I think just last week or the week before, get rid of AV, you know, of third-party AV now, at least on the Windows platform, because Microsoft, just as they did with the firewall and the previous firewall vendors, they've done this with AV and the hopefully soon-to-be previous AV vendors. There's a built-in solution that solves this in a secure way from a company that is on the ball, except for a little delayed Patch Tuesday today on Valentine's Day, is keeping things current and updating monthly. You know, just go with the one that's built in. And so finally, I conclude by reminding everyone that so long as the intercepting proxy, whether it is middle box appliance or AV, as long as it does not have the ability to on the fly synthesize certificates which are trusted by the global public trusted root store, and no certificate authority will willingly or at least publicly allow this, or they would become untrusted. This interception can only be done with the knowledge of the user's browser client, which has chosen to trust the public key installed into it by the proxy's vendor. So an interesting possibility here would be the explicit notification to the user when a non-globally trusted certificate is being used for any connection. In other words, for the browser, which certainly knows whether the certificate that has been used to sign this connection is part of the global trust store or was added on afterwards, that would be nice to display to the user. Not that a user in a corporation has any choice, but at least being informed that your connection is being intercepted, even if it's benign interception. I think that's what we should have, and we can have it. That is an unspoofable, robust compromise that at least tells the user something between here and there cracked this connection open in order to look into it. Maybe you have no choice if you're in a corporate intranet, but, you know, being informed, I think, is the least we can do. And until then, we as an industry, we have a conundrum, because we want our data to be secure, but we also want it to be safe. So anyway, great, great piece of work and great research. And wow, nice to know that, you know, 11% of connections are today being cracked open, and most of them have their security damaged as a consequence. So it's not even benign.
Anything, you know, as an end user you can do about that? Not really.
No, yeah. Not really. Now, most AV products give you an option to turn that off.
Okay.
That's certainly something you would want to do. You know, okay. This like it's defaults on because they're thinking that's a benefit. I would turn that off. I would just say, yeah. But then, of course, I mean, if you're a person who wants a third-party AV, you want it to scan the stuff coming in over HTTPS.
Right.
You know, so it's like, well, you don't want to turn that off because you want the benefit of it being able to look into your secure connections on your behalf.
Right.
But the problem is 24 out of 26 of them do it badly so that it hurts your security.
Wow.
Yeah.
Kind of amazing.
Yeah. We're just in a tough time right now. We need to get past this somehow. And,
yeah.
You know, we will.
Well, yeah. And in the meantime, you're here. Thank goodness.
That's right. And we'll be back next week. We'll be back next week for episode 600.
Wow. Wow, 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 wow. Ladies and gentlemen, we do this show every week for 600 darn weeks. That's an awful lot. And we plan to keep on doing it as long as you keep on listening. You can catch it live every Wednesday at Tuesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern Time, 2130 UTC. Join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. But if you don't want to do it live, and by the way, if you want to watch live, you can watch on our website, twit.tv/live, or on the YouTube Live we have now, youtube.com/twit, or a Ustream, or Twitch, twitch.tv/twit. There are a lot of places to watch. Actually, if you go to our website, you'll have a choice. You can also watch or listen on demand. Steve has audio at his website, grc.com, as well as transcripts. It takes about, a day or two after the show for a...
Yeah, I normally get it either... So today's Tuesday. Normally Thursday morning, okay. I find it that Elaine will have mailed them, and I got them posted as quickly as I can.
Show notes are also at grc.com, and that's helpful if you want to see the pictures Steve talks about or get the links to the research he's talking about. Where do you keep those? All in the same place as the shows, right? It's all in the same place.
Yeah. Yep. grc.com/sn.
Okay. We don't have that, but we do have audio and video of the show at twit.tv/sn. And actually, the way most people do it is they find their favorite podcast application and they subscribe. That way they get it each and every week. You don't want to miss an episode. Is there anybody listening right now, show of hands, who has listened to all 599 episodes, besides you and me, Steve? Actually, I haven't even listened to all 599 episodes. I've missed more than a few on vacations. I bet you half the audience has listened to every show. And the rest are trying to catch up. Bill in Michigan raises his hand. Good job. Strengths raises his hand. Yeah, all of them. What are you, Jay's saying all? Yeah, all. 599 episodes. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it. And we will see you next Tuesday for Security Now.
Thanks, Leo.